Good afternoon and welcome to the new extended version of Wavelength, which now starts at 2:30 and proceeds relentlessly towards 3:30 when it ends after 60 minutes. Some of you might be disorientated by not hearing the clock chime at 3 p.m. as it has done for several years. Many of you might be thoroughly attuned to that time of day on Friday, and as 3 p.m. approaches and your mind and body expect to hear the ticking and chiming, you might experience discombobulation and wander aimlessly murmuring, "I'm late for a very important date," or have feelings of panic and nausea. For those avid listeners, I will play the chimes at 3 p.m. as well, just this week. Next week, as 3 p.m. approaches, take medication, lie down, or even create your own chimes. Hold a clock next to your head and set the alarm for 3 p.m. So to take us up to 3 p.m. this week, I'll play a nice long track by John Lennon and Yoko Ono called Cambridge 1969 from Unfinished Music No. 2, Life with the Lions. Music which prompted George Martin to comment at the time, "No comment."
This is a piece called Cambridge 1969.
Yeah. Yeah!
good afternoon again. The clock has chimed twice now, once at the new time of 2:30, and then again at the old time of 3 p.m. To spare disorientation on the part of avid listeners. As of today, Wavelength will broadcast for 60 minutes, starting at 2:30 on Fridays, and repeat at some other time yet to be nailed down. So that opening track was Cambridge 1969 by John Lennon and Yoko Ono from Unfinished Music No. 2, Life with the Lions, which ends with accompaniment from John Stevens on percussion and John Chikai on saxophone. I hope that's the right pronunciation for Chikai. So this track is quite therapeutic, especially through headphones, and like some wine, improves with age, I think. At the time of its release, George Martin commented, "No comment." Perhaps the Beatles could have stuck together and become a free-form improvising outfit. Anyway. So, you are listening to the new extended Wavelength on Resonance 104.4 FM with me, William English. Next week's guest will be Paul Gorman, a journalist, author and commentator on visual culture with a distinguished career in fashion, music and campaigning journalism. Paul wrote a book called The Look, Adventures in Pop and Rock Fashion, and is presently writing about and curating a show of the work of Tommy Roberts, founder of the influential clothes shop Kleptomania and Mr. Freedom. Speaking of Kleptomania, as I was, I'm trying to track down Janice Kerbel. That's Janice K-E-R-B-E-L, artist and author of an extraordinary artist's book called 15 Lombard Street, published by Bookworks in 2001. My efforts to track Janice down via the publisher of this book and one of the galleries she exhibited at have come to nothing. If anyone out there knows the whereabouts of Janice Kerbel, please let me know. You can get in touch via Resonance. The book in question, 15 Lombard Street, is a 100-page paperback with a plain grey front cover and an aerial photograph on the back, illustrated with numerous black-and-white photographs and a detailed map of Lombard Street in the City of London. 15 Lombard Street is the site of Coutts Bank, principally a private investment bank and a global organisation managing assets of more than £30 billion. That was in 2001. Accounts can only be opened by those with more than £500,000 or more to invest. Large amounts of cash regularly pass through 15 Lombard Street, or at least they did. When I phoned the press office of Coutts Bank, I was told that there is no Coutts Bank at that address and never has been. I googled the address and found Coutts Bank. I phoned back to the Coutts Bank press office and told the person about this. "What do you want to know?" he said. I said that I was interested in Janice Kerbel's book, 15 Lombard Street. He apparently had never heard of the book, and neither had their archivist. I should point out that the book is a careful, exhaustively researched and systematic exposition of how to rob this particular bank, including maps, diagrams and a detailed description of the getaway. Well, as I said, I have been unable to contact Janice Kerbel. Coutts no longer occupy 15 Lombard Street and the book is exceptionally rare. No copies are available on the internet. Though the publisher Bookworks still list it as one of their titles, but out of print and unavailable. So I would love to talk to Janice Kerbel about this fascinating tome, so please get in touch. Here is one short passage from the book, which seems to be written in all seriousness. It's not a sort of spoof book, although obviously the idea of writing about robbing a bank publicly is fairly ridiculous because it would, of course, alert the bank. But here is one short passage from the book. It doesn't seem possible that the book could have been written without the knowledge of the bank. Maybe they were given a copy after publication and it's been buried in a vault. But here we go. This is page 29. The armoured vehicle en route to 15 Lombard Street to collect its supply of unmarked cash is diverted into a collision. Transmission in the general area of the collision is jammed and the armoured vehicle is unable to report the accident and its subsequent delay. The bank's ventilation is sabotaged, causing a foul smell to permeate the building. Three men disguised as air conditioning repairmen arrive at 15 Lombard Street in a company van at the precise time the armoured vehicle is due for collection. Two of the repairmen are granted entry to the central control room from the side garage. The other repairman seizes the side security guard and deactivates detection sensors in the holding position. Alone in the control room, the two repairmen remove their overalls, under which they wear armoured vehicle guard uniforms. They proceed to the holding position and receive the money ready for collection. The fire alarm is sounded, unlocking all fire exit doors from the inside. A number of explosives are detonated along the getaway route that leads to a deserted car park where three vehicles are parked. The air conditioning van is destroyed with explosives. The team split up into the vehicles and each departs, following separate routes to a villa in Garrucha on the southeast coast of Spain. And the book goes on like this, with a sort of detailed description of the bank, all the sort of comings and goings, photographs, numerous photographs, and a great sort of description of the getaway, sort of how the people split up and they all meet up again in Spain. But it's not written like a novel. It is literally a plan of how to rob the bank by Janice Kerbel. Okay, well, this seems an opportune moment to play The Great Train Robbery by Mountain, who formed in the late 60s, somewhat in the wake and style of Cream, with Leslie West and Felix Pappalardi. Mountain reformed in 1981, but their time was past. They were unable to reunite in 1983 because Felix Pappalardi was shot dead by his wife, Gail Collins. Leslie West noted at the time, "Unfortunately, his wife, Gail Collins, dressed him and made him these ugly clothes I wouldn't be buried in. Not only did Gail dress him, but she shot him and wrote a great deal of our lyrics, not by my choice." It leads me to wonder what the clothes looked like. Anyway, here we go. This is a track by Mountain.
Thank you.
Okay, that was The Great Train Robbery by Mountain with Leslie West and Felix Pappalardi. So we have one missing person. Call out for artist Janice Kerbel, author of 15 Lombard Street. And there's another person I want to contact. This is a sort of personal communication for someone from the past. Orrin Anderson. Orrin was studying English literature at Leicester University back in the Stone Age. He arrived one day at my parents' quiet thatched pub in a village in Leicestershire, driving a gold Renault Floride, quite rare then and probably unobtainable now, wearing army fatigues. Orrin hailed from South Carolina and had been in the American forces, which somehow allowed him to take my brother and me onto a US Air Force base in Cambridgeshire. This strange experience was like visiting the USA without actually leaving England. Once inside the outer perimeter, one was surrounded by Americana of all sorts, aeroplanes, of course, American cars, uniforms, lots of actual Americans, all speaking fluent American, and a PX shop, which was fascinating. And we stocked up on alien foodstuffs, such as hominy grits and Mexican TV dinners, which we took back to the village pub. Later, I acquired a wooden Bal Ami jukebox, which was being thrown out of a Leicester pub, and got it working in the kitchen. My father refusing to have it in the old world pub as he couldn't get Rachmaninoff on 45 RPM 7-inch singles. Orrin Anderson played the guitar, and he had had a demo single cut in the States, and he contributed this single to my jukebox with the proviso that I would return it to him one day. The single is on the Richland Custom Recording Label, 2515 Divine Street, Columbia, South Carolina, and is signed to Will for the jukebox, Orrin. Both tracks are written by Orrin. Side one is called Adam, side two, Misty Gardens. And it has to be said that neither track was going to launch Orrin into any kind of stardom. But his rendition of Fire and Rain was poetic and haunting, but perhaps you can't fail with that particular song. So now, in this age of internet radio, perhaps Orrin Anderson from South Carolina, or anyone who knows his whereabouts, could contact me through Resonance so I could return the record to him. So this is Adam by Orrin Anderson.
Sorry for old Adam, just as sorry as I could be, for he never had no daddy for to hold him on his knee, for he never had no childhood playing around that cabin door, and he never had no mammy for to send him to the store. I feel so sorry for old Adam when I'm resting close beside a pool, for he never did go fishing when he should have been in school. I guess I will always have a feeling that he should have let that apple be. But I kinda guess old Adam must have been a lot like me. I feel so sorry for old Adam. I feel so sorry for old Adam, 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 Adam. Oh.
Yeah, well, that's Adam by Orrin Anderson. If you're out there, Orrin, give me a call. Okay. Yes, calls out for Janice Kerbel and Orrin Anderson. You've been listening to Wavelength on Resonance 104.4 FM. Next week's guest is Paul Gorman, journalist, fashion commentator, author, and he will talk about his forthcoming book on Tommy Roberts, founder of two seminal shops, Kleptomania and Mr. Freedom, and he will be bringing some rare vinyl along too. Today's program ends with Objects and Spaces by Audio Arts, a transparent 33 RPM flexi-disc, which accompanied the catalogue for the Sculpture Show in 1983. The flexi-disc is so flimsy that there is a printed suggestion in the middle, suggesting that you could place a small coin here within a printed circle if the flexible record slips on the turntable. But we'll give it a try without the coin and see what happens.
Living space at the moment is a prison cell, which measures about 12 feet long by about 6 feet wide. It's possibly 8 feet high. And within that cell there are three beds, three cupboards within which to house one's personal possessions, three chairs, a table, three buckets which act as toilets when the cell is closed. All those objects take up something in the region of perhaps 60 of the 72 square feet available, leaving very little space to move around.
Well, there isn't a great deal really to say about it. It's a very small confined space. It's probably a room about 14 by about 6 foot wide, and doesn't accord us a great deal of space. I have a bed, and everything I do is really situated around the bed, as far as reading, writing, and anything else. We don't have much room at all, basically because there are two other people living in the same room, so we're rather limited.
My living space. Well, it's a brick-built cell inside Brixton Jail, which I believe was built in the Victorian times. The size of it is approximately 6 feet wide. It is actually only about 10 feet long, and it is between 9 and 10 feet high. That is the one good thing about it. Compared to modern building, it has that greater height, which is very important when you've only got three people in it. It has a very large metal-covered door that every time it closes makes the most ominous sound with a large sliding lock.
possibly the table where I can write on. It's probably the most important object because it's the one where I can do things at, i.e. write, read.
The bed, in fact, constitutes a part of nearly every activity within the cell, apart from the occasional time when I'm sitting on a chair eating a meal at the table. But there is only room for two people to eat at that table. So if not me, one of the others has to use his bed to eat as well. It's not just a bed for sleeping, it's a chair for sitting on. That is lying on the bed. It's a library, if one considers that I read whilst on the bed. The bed, in fact, constitutes a part of nearly every activity within the cell.
When I feel tired, the bed is the most important object. The only thing about the bed is, and this is, I think, quite interesting, because I've been in a number of different cells since I've been here, it is, I think, possibly the one bit of the cell that is private.
Trying to construct the space in which I will be living on release. I try and construct the things, the events, the happenings, and the articles that I want to have when I am free to do so. Living in the space where, in fact, I lived before I came here.
I tend not to think of very much other than what I'm reading. If I'm not reading, I try and go straight to sleep.
I think mainly about my own private life and other things I would like to be doing.
There is no privacy, because one is almost never alone.
But I would like to have, perhaps a room where I could use personally that would be privately my own.
And I'd also like a small area, which, even if it wasn't mine all the time, could be mine for moments of solitude.
Stardust, space cadet, you cannot escape the Dorfield robots. Dorfield robots, attack, attack.
The emptiness, and within it are the sun I live near and the world I live on. Most of this world is covered with the living waters, but there are also land and air. On one spot of the land is a long fjord, miscalled the Hudson River. On a hill over it is a defrocked church. In the church is a ruined piano. This puzzles me. Just turning it into some sculpture work seems inadequate. Dick Higgins.
Okay, this is Vittorio Baroni from Italy, but end of time.
I'm standing in Royal Avenue, which is one of the main business streets in Belfast. It runs north from City Hall to York Street. In Royal Avenue, there are four security barriers, two at either end of the street. Anyone entering Royal Avenue must go through one of those barriers and be searched. No matter how necessary, how thorough or cursory the search, the security barrier is a daily reminder of breach in human trust here. This is Alistair MacLennan in Belfast, and now over to an object and a space in Warsaw.
We are in May 1983 in Warsaw. This is a small room of the Foxel Gallery, office and gallery archives. The only window looks on the courtyard paved with cobblestones, and there are some big chestnut trees visible through the window. There are also some paintings on the walls, some little art objects like a model of a ladder by Bodichko, Cantor's picture with umbrella.
I am now sitting in front of a